Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, June 14th. Today, it's time to talk music again with Sun writer Kevin Simpson and G. Brown, director of the Colorado Music Experience. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Pinnacle Assurance, Colorado's leading provider of workers' compensation insurance. Pinnacle provides caring protection that Colorado businesses can rely on as they expand across the country. From finance to robotics and Arizona to Orlando, Pinnacle's nationwide coverage goes wherever Colorado businesses grow. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1864, chemistry professor Nathaniel Hill arrived in Denver to scout mineral resources. Despite Colorado's challenging year, Hill's expertise brought hope. He bought property in Gilpin County to test ore and traveled to England in 1866 to learn about smelting. In 1867, Hill's Boston and Colorado Smelting Company in Blackhawk revived mining. By the early 1870s, he expanded operations and moved the plant to Denver. Hill's success in smelting led to investments in various industries and a political career, culminating in his election to the U.S. Senate in 1879. His legacy is honored with a stained glass portrait in the Colorado State Capitol. Before we continue, tickets are now available for SunFest 2024 for a better Colorado. The event will take place September 27th at the University of Denver Joseph Corbell School of International Studies. Join the day-long event where people who care about Colorado explore solutions to the state's most pressing issues. Get your tickets today by visiting coloradosun.com/sunfest. Next, our feature story.
Welcome to another Friday, listeners, on the edge of another great Colorado weekend. And welcome to my friend G. Brown, who oversees colomusic.org. That's the Colorado Music Experience, a perfect place to explore the state's rich musical history with everything from artist profiles to recordings of live performances at local venues. And we've got a sampling of that later in the segment, by the way. How's it going, G?
Oh, things are well, Kevin. It strikes me that people tell me I'm like red wine, getting better with age, but still not for everyone.
All right. Well, we've talked before on the podcast about your on-record books that explore each year in music from 78 to 98. And you just released two more editions for the years 1979, 1986. And folks actually might have recognized that intro music from the year 1986, Peter Gabriel, Sledgehammer. But you can find the books at onrecordbooks.com. And gee, I've seen your archives in your basement and the sheer volume of material that you've amassed over the years. And I'm wondering, do you have a favorite year when you look at that span in music history? You've done quite a few of them now, and I wonder if there's one that stands out for whatever reason.
Yeah, I'm writing number 19 right now out of ostensibly 21. So I'm close to covering the gamut. And the short answer, Kevin, is no. I can't afford to have a favorite year. I mean, if I had to name a favorite year in music, it would precede these dates. You know, I'm a 60s pop guy. But the whole concept of the books was to give equal measure to these years. When we launched, we had three volumes, 1978, which was the classic rock wheelhouse, right?
Oh, yeah.
1984, the apex of the MTV era with Prince and Cyndi Lauper and Madonna and Huey Lewis, Tina Turner, and then jumped to 1991, which was the grunge era. Got Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and everything else. These books are comprehensive. They cover all the genres. But leading with those three, Murderer's Rows, if you will, I wondered if the other volumes would have the same sustainability, the same cachet. And they absolutely do, right? Just because one person graduated from college or high school in a certain year, you know, everybody has that year. And it's not a matter of whether great music came out in that year. Great music comes out in every year for the people paying attention. We all listen to music in different ways. And I'm not going to be the old guy who says, well, when I was a kid, it was a lot better. It was, but I'm not going to say that if he's wrong. Okay. So I hope that's not evasive, but I'm just fiercely proud that these books cover the gamut. And I think that they will resonate with anyone who's got an interest in a particular year. And I tried to keep my personal input out of it. This is reportage, not my memoirs or my essays on what it all meant. This is pretty factual in content.
Well, I got to say, one of the other really fun things about that site, onrecordbooks.com, you've got a music trivia quiz for each year. And we've done this before, and we're going to do it again. I took 79 and 86 quizzes, got a respectable 8 out of 10 for 1979, which is one of those wheelhouse years you talk about. And kind of a pathetic 5 out of 10 on 86. I just wasn't paying attention during the 80s for whatever reason. But
I don't know about pathetic, Kevin. You know, a solid C minus.
You're being generous here, but some of those questions were really tough, I got to say. But let's let our listeners ponder a question from one of those quizzes, and we'll give them the answer at the end of the segment. So what have you got?
Well, how about if we go to 1979 and Fleetwood Mac's Tusk, the title track from the album of the same name? That song was augmented by 112 members of what musical group? Was it A, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, B, the London Festival Orchestra, C, John Mayall's Blues Breakers, or D, the University of Southern California Trojan Marching Band? Which one of those musical groups augmented Fleetwood Mac's Tusk with 112 musicians?
Okay, well, think about that one, listeners. It's a tricky one, especially if you haven't heard the song. we'll have the answer in a few minutes. But speaking of 1979, gee, I noticed that the Colorado Music Experience added some more audio to its archive, in particular, a live recording, local, by Journey from back in 79. Tell us about that and another song that you've added to the archive.
Yeah, of the latter, it's a track from a group called Beggar's Opera Company. This was one of the groups, one of the many groups in the 60s that eventually became Sugarloaf. It seemed like members were mixing and matching in various bands throughout that decade, and then finally emerging with the consummate Sugarloaf lineup. So with Beggar's Opera Company, Denny Flanagan, Bob Weber, and Bob McVitie of the Moonrakers, who were Denver's biggest band of the mid-60s, they teamed up with Gene Chalk and Bob Raymond of the Soul Survivors. This is about 1967, put out one rare, locally pressed 45. Strange True Love was the A-side, and we've managed to remaster that and get that on the site. So that's exciting. It's under the Sugarloaf Rarities category. But the Journey song is really exciting to me. They were in concert at the venerable Rainbow Music Hall back in 1979. And within the set, they played the songs Feeling That Way and Anytime. And if you recall, they were sequenced on the Infinity album, the band's first with Steve Perry, their new vocalist. But radio stations used to play them consecutive as well. And in concert, they segued between the two songs in the same way on the Rainbow stage. And it's really pretty cool.
So let's play a clip for our listeners. Which one of those two have you got queued up for us?
Oh, got to be Journey.
Got to be.
Really well recorded and They were, you know, terrific band. And this is when they were just starting to show it off.
All right, here we go. Journey live in Denver. Well, Chi, we've recently lost some more musical icons. It seems too often that we have to say that, but this time from performers to someone on the business side of the industry to one super fan. And you did short but incredibly informative pieces for the Colorado Music Experience website on these folks. And in that superfan category, we were just talking last month, in fact, about basketball great Bill Walton and his love for the Grateful Dead in light of the symposium up there in Boulder. But reading your piece on him after he passed away late last month, he told you a lot of interesting things when you caught up to him during his sportscasting career, and I did not even realize that happened. But tell us a little bit about Bill and some of the insights that he gave you.
Yeah, Bill gave his insights to a lot of folks. it was interesting. I was proud to post a photo that was taken of the two of us about 5 years ago. And then we were flooded with photos from people in the cycling community in Boulder who had, you know, intersected with them, people through all walks of life. He was a man of the people, if you will, just very gregarious. It's easy to forget that back in the 70s, during his playing days, he was a countercultural figure, you know,
oh, absolutely.
6 foot, 11 inch athlete with long hair and a beard and headband and, you know, and loving the Grateful Dead. That wasn't really the model at the time. why am I flashing on the late Jerry West right now? Those guys
really
at odds, but Bill mellowed over the years. He was always gregarious, and I had the nicest time with him in the mid-90s when he had left the beard behind for a suit and tie and became a sportscaster and a very renowned one as well. He still loved music. I interviewed him after he was analyzing a Denver Nuggets game at the old McNichols Arena, and he was carrying a Roland keyboard to his bus because he was learning how to play piano. He wanted to participate a little more. At that juncture, mid-90s again, he had put out a CD, actually, on a spoken word label, New Alliance Records. It was called Men Are Made in the Paint, and it was a double CD where he recorded his impressions of basketball and how the game serves as a metaphor for winning in life as well. About 2.5 hours of his expertise. But what was cool is the words were interspersed with musical performances. Ray Manzarek, the old Doors keyboardist, did a lot. Jerry Garcia and Mickey Hart of the Dead threw in the liner notes. So even his spoken word CD had a musical presence to it. His connections with the Dead really could be traced back to 1978, when he actually played drums with them on stage when they were over in Egypt at the pyramids. And that kind of ties in here locally, because that same year they played Red Rocks here in Colorado for the first time, and we're the first band to really understand Red Rocks as what they called a power spot, like the pyramids in Egypt, you know, just some place where spiritual and nature elements came into play. You've been there, Kevin. You know,
absolutely.
So it was great. Walton was at that show, and he was in a cast because he just broken his leg. He'd won his first NBA championship and was supposed to be in training camp with the Portland Trail Blazers, and instead he's following the Dead around. So I said, well, what am I supposed to do? Be with them handing out Band-Aids? You know, I'm in a cast. I can't do anything if I'm there. So he was a trip. Always claimed to use rock music for inspiration before games. Said that he always had a Dead song running through his head when he was triggering the fast break. So quite the character.
Never at a loss for words, for sure. I was lucky enough to cover him in the later years of his career when I was covering the Nuggets and then would move on to the playoffs while he was finishing his career with another NBA championship with the Boston Celtics. So never at a loss for words, for sure. But another loss that we did have was the renowned saxophonist David Sanborn, also died last month. Was just an amazingly ubiquitous figure, playing not only on his own, but with a virtual who's who of pop and rock performers.
Yeah, his peak was in the late 80s. And yeah, he had a foot in both camps. On his own, he was on top of the jazz charts pretty consistently. He was doing a contemporary style of jazz, right? It wasn't the traditional jazz at that juncture in time. Mixing in elements of pop, which kind of got him in trouble with the old guard, but not like they should have anything to say about it, right? He'd won 5 Grammys at that point. On television, he was co-host of a show called Sunday Night, kind of a late-night alternative music series. He hosted his own weekly national broadcast on radio called The Jazz Show with David Sanborn, and he was always touring. He played Red Rocks in 87 and Fiddler's Green in 89, and that's when we really had a chance to visit. He had quite the start. Everyone knows about his passion for the saxophone, went back to his childhood, but he started out as a rocker. He played with Paul Butterfield. Remember Paul Butterfield Blues Band?
Blues Band, yeah, absolutely.
Great acts of the late 60s. But over the course of the 70s and 80s, he started earning recognition from the musical establishment. He recorded and toured with Stevie Wonder, notably the Talking Book album, James Taylor on the hit How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, Springsteen, Paul Simon, The Stones, The Eagles, Dan Fogelberg, many, many iconic stars. And then he brought his talents into living rooms nationwide with his regular guest slot with the studio band on Late Night with David Letterman on NBC. He was always sitting in with those cats. So he was an amazing talent, amazingly prolific, and again, had to deal with his dismissal by jazz purists, but I would say in retrospect, totally unfair. Well, he did let it bug him. He did okay.
Well, one of the really amazing details that you point out in your piece on the Colorado Music Experience site is how difficult it was to sit in with Paul Schaefer on the Letterman show, which I found fascinating. You think, you know, you get the impression these guys, oh, they all know what they're doing. They're just sitting back having a good time. But it was kind of intense, it sounded like.
Apparently, you know, no rehearsals, no tip-offs. Someone would come on stage, a guest, to talk with Letterman, and Paul would make some arcane musical reference, right? He'd always play some song that the title referred to the guest career, some, but just shout it out, you know, Rawhide on 4, you know, and boom, you had to know it. You had to know it. Or if you didn't, you sure had to act like and not a real big safety net there. So yeah, he hated that, and he didn't hate it, but it was a challenge. He was equally challenged by all the section work he did, what he was most famous for, but he didn't really appreciate the fact that being a gun for hire, not being able to stretch, having to operate under other people's dictums, you know, he was a pretty creative cat, and was kind of sat on a lot, doing, you know, lots and lots of session work. Everyone had different needs, and they didn't always match up with his artistic vision.
Well, bringing this topic back around to Colorado again, you had the honor of attending a celebration of life for a gentleman named Scott O'Malley, who passed away about 6 months ago. A lot of folks may not be familiar with Scott. Tell us a little about the impact that he had on music in Colorado, because it was pretty widespread.
He was a wonderful and amazing soul. Scott, from the Midwest, a band called the Buffalo Brothers, brought him out to Colorado, and he centered down in Colorado Springs. And in 1996, he founded the Western Jubilee Recording Company. He repurposed an old railroad warehouse right off of downtown Colorado Springs. And he was a champion of Western music, not country and Western, but Western music, cowboy music, right? People like Waddy Mitchell, Don Edwards. He represented them, Norman Blake, the guitar legend, all these renowned artists who aren't household names, but totally respected in the acoustic music world. And the venue served as a concert. It served as a concert venue as well as a record label. He also managed Flash Cadillac, who are notorious as the best loved 50s oldies band in America. He did that for decades. The thing that was so great about Scott is that he was, to be charitable, a collector of memorabilia. Hoarder, pack rat, other things could apply. He was not haphazard about it. It was all just meticulously detailed, everything from quilts and rugs. A lot of them hang behind the wall, behind the stage at Western Jubilee. Old metal signs, train sets. He had the most amazing setup that started with his father tucked away in a corner of the building. The most amazing train set I've ever seen. Old baseball gloves, you name it, he had it, and all cataloged and stuff. A real gentle soul, always had great stories, a droll sense of humor. Yeah, his passing leaves a huge hole in the entertainment community here in Colorado, Southern Colorado in particular. I miss my friend.
Well, to honor all three of the men we just talked about, it seems like this might be a great spot for a David Sanborn sax solo. What do you suggest?
Well, that's kind of easy. I think he was best known for his work on David Bowie's Young Americans. To call this a solo, though, is kind of a misnomer. He pretty much plays through the entire song. So let her rip.
All right, here we go. David Sanborn on David Bowie's Young Americans. Well, to wrap things up, G, let's see if listeners knew the answer to your 1979 trivia question. Fleetwood Mac's Tusk was augmented by 112 members of what musical group? A. Mormon Tabernacle Choir, B. London Festival Orchestra, C. John Mayall's Blues Breakers, or D. The University of Southern California Trojan Marching Band? What's the correct answer, sir?
It is D, the USC Trojan Marching Band. It should be noted that Lindsey Buckingham's bandmates in Fleetwood Mac thought he was totally nuts to do this. But yes, he recorded all those folks to give some depth and texture to the song Tusk. And we talk about, Kevin, just the wrong answers, right? So Mormon Tabernacle Choir. You know, that's kind of a stretch, right?
Yeah, it's feasible, though. It's possible.
But I guess the London Festival Orchestra was who backed the Moody Blues on their famous Days of Future Past album with Knights in White Satin, the first orchestral rock type recording back in the late 60s. So that's why that name might ring a bell. John Mayall's Blues Breakers. John was the host for pretty much every guitarist to come out of Britain. He probably had 112 guitarists that were his ranks, but they were not part of Fleetwood Mac's Tusk. So anyway, that's by the process of elimination what we were up to.
All right. And with that, we'll play our way into the weekend with this clip from Fleetwood Mac's Tusk, featuring, yes, the USC Trojan Marching Band. And it's really kind of remarkable that it works so well. Thanks, G. We'll do this again next month.
Look forward to it, Kevin, as always.
And listeners, remember, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. See you next time.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A Colorado nonprofit is calling on school leaders statewide to repair or replace hundreds of sinks and drinking fountains. A recent analysis by the Colorado Public Interest Research Groups found that many of those fixtures had high levels of lead in them when testing was done on them more than a year ago. Of the 2,200 water fixtures that tested positive for high levels of lead in the 10 largest Colorado school districts in May 2023, more than 1,400 still have not yet been fixed, according to the report released last week. Officials investigating the Interlochen fire near Twin Lakes say an abandoned campfire is what ignited the wildfire Tuesday. The Forest Service said an investigator located a campfire ring left 60 yards from the Interlochen Trail and 1.5 miles from the trailhead where the fire likely started. The campfire was not properly extinguished and continued to burn. It is believed that the campfire was abandoned several days prior to its report Tuesday. As of Thursday afternoon, the fire had burned nearly 600 acres in Lake County. Water levels in Colorado rivers are rising, and so too are the number of deaths on the state's waterways. At least 18 people have died in Colorado's rivers, streams, and reservoirs this year as flows reach historic highs, including a coordinated release to benefit endangered fish in the Colorado River. The Coordinated Reservoir Operations Program deploys sustained, not-quite-flood-stage flows through the second week of June to help endangered fish along the 15-mile reach of the Colorado River as it traverses the Grand Valley upstream of Grand Junction. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect, issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.